4 billion years ago, as life evolved, the first organisms were static, and their movement depended entirely on the flow of currents in the water they inhabited. As the first simple organisms, cyanobacteria, developed the means to move, information processing enabled this remarkable competitive advantage over their static rivals. The ability to turn information about light, heat, and chemical concentrations propelled the development of sensory mechanisms and eventually the brain. At its core, perception, the way we make sense of the world, is founded on our capacity to process information. So the significance of how we feel and what this information can tell us continues to fascinate us. In this special show, my colleague Emma Sinclair talks to one of our community of neuroscientists, Oscar Hutton, about his review of interoception, a primary sensory mechanism that shapes our mindset, how we feel, see, and think.
In this conversation, we're joined by the wonderful Oscar Hutton, a consultant neuroscientist, researcher, and key member of our community, who throughout 2022 spent lots of time helping us explore and make sense of the neuroscience research that could help us answer this question. Does listening to your body help you become more empathetic? By delving into a relatively new line of neuroscience research, that of interoception and how we feel on the inside, Oscar's helped paint a picture of what we believe could provide a counterintuitive move for how we understand others and, crucially, how we build empathy as human beings. This conversation brings to life the journey we took and the many questions that began to arise as we started to understand what the world of neuroscience can teach us about being with others. What's going on inside when we're around others? What's happening when we know people well or less well? And can we actively grow our connection and relationships with people by tapping into our brains and crucially our bodies when we're experiencing social situations? So some very big questions, and there are a few parts to this conversation. We begin by setting the link between interoception and empathy, understanding the popular and scientific definition of empathy and what it's for, and the evolutionary and business cases for building empathy. We then ask, how can we build empathy and what interoception really is, before diving into the compelling research that's building the case for us to understand the information our bodies can tell us at any point in time. From here, we consider how we can use our own experiences to understand the feelings and perspectives of other people and how we can build our own interoceptive accuracy. And we finish up by understanding how to use our feelings on the inside for better social interactions. How can we help perspective taking, see social cues better, and regulate our own emotions around others to support ourselves and others better? Finally, Oscar does also offer some amazing insights into how anyone can build interoceptive awareness, how they can feel on the inside, and he shares some great examples of what children learn at school, some simple training exercises we can all try, and power posing. I really hope you enjoy this as much as we did creating it. We begin with an introduction here from Oscar about his work and the research that got us started.
Yeah, so hi, I am a neuroscientist with a degree in neuroscience from the University of Nottingham. And earlier this year, about February time, I started having conversations with Outside about looking at this new topic of interoception. And I just started looking at it as a general topic, how it can be useful for us and how it can benefit us. And I was surprised to see a few different articles mentioning how interoception can affect empathy. And the best example that I found was a study by Fukushima and colleagues in 2011, which measured the brain's electrical response to the heart beating and found that our brains respond more to the heart beating when we're empathizing with other people. And this indicated that we use how our own bodies feel to inform us about the emotional states of other people. Well, this left me asking the question, Could this give us a new, possibly counterintuitive way to build one of the most important qualities that we have as humans, our empathy? So I delved into this research, and today I wanted to share what I found and what amazing work has already been done by neuroscientists and psychologists in the field.
Well, I think this is amazing. Before we delve in, because we're going to talk about that counterintuitive move, and I love that, I think we should probably just kind of rein it back a little bit and just set that scene in terms of like the topic of empathy. So we're holding two things here: how our bodies and the new science around feeling on the inside can give us more insight into how we are with others. So two really big topics that you're bringing together here. So let's just think about that concept of empathy then before we jump into that counterintuitive move. And we'll spend a bit of time focusing on that area and what it is and what it's for when we consider perhaps relationships and social interactions. And I think when I started pulling this together and thinking about, you know, multiple ways that we can use to think about empathy, I realized just how much content is out there and how much of a definition there is in terms of like that working definition, how it evolves. And there's very different ways that people describe it and use it as a concept. And I think it feels kind of fair to say that empathy is a word perhaps that most people use, and they might, as I say, have their own working definitions. But as that concept, it's actually really quite hard to get your arms around. And I think that, I don't know, but my suspect is because that this very nature, it's emotional. So I'll run you through a few that I've found, and then I'd absolutely love it if we could like hone in on definitions that you've been using and that have you've helping you to make sense of it over the last year. But so I love this one. A definition from the dictionary is the action of understanding, being aware of, being sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings, thoughts, and experience of another. That is quite a lot in there to pull apart. Another one that I found was empathy is the ability to emotionally understand what other people feel, see things from their point of view, perhaps imagine, you know, yourself in their place, and essentially putting yourself in someone else's position and feeling what they're feeling. So I was kind of getting this sense, and I know when I talk to people, a lot of people come back and talk to me about it being like walking in another person's shoes, sitting in someone else's chair, seeing another view. So this kind of got this own, like almost this kind of, you know, embodied sense of what it is to empathize. And then I just because of the stuff that I read and the things that I think are really inspiring as well, you know, Brené Brown and the wonder that she is in the leadership world talks about how it's fueling connections and feeling with people. It's almost like that sacred space, you know, joining someone in their space, knowing what that feels like, making the choice, therefore, to enter in quite a vulnerable space where we have to connect the feelings ourselves and not necessarily, you know, respond to help another person. And you know, taking another person's view, holding that as different to your own, and then and holding that without judgment, it's almost this sense of like, you know, capturing a physical space that you're in with somebody else and you choose to be there with them. And I, you know, I've seen this in terms of how people, you know, learn to listen, how people learn to be with other people. And I just thought there's kind of those two parts that to pull apart there. There's almost like a thinking perspective and then, you know, imagining people's worlds, and then a feeling part of actually living through that experience with someone else's emotions. And I know that's just kind of one concept area, but it just made me realize it's such a big topic for people to understand. So I don't know if any of that kind of came to the fore when you started delving in, Oscar, and how you started to make sense of that from, you know, perhaps a definition we can really hold on to and understand when we think about perhaps interoception a bit later on.
Yeah, so that's basically the same concept that is in a lot of the neuroscientific papers and that kind of thing. But they just have specific names. So obviously for social interactions to go smoothly, the person talking needs to be able to understand and feel the emotional state of the listener and vice versa. So we all know this as empathy. And in the neuroscientific world, empathy can be divided into two related components, which you touched on, affective and cognitive empathy. So affective empathy involves automatically experiencing the emotional state of another person, whilst cognitive empathy is the active process of accurately imagining the other person's perspective. These elements of empathy are not separate, but exist on a spectrum. They're both beneficial, but the ideal amount of each depends on the situation and varies from person to person.
That's really interesting. So this sense that you've got holding a frame in your head at the same time as, you know, I guess physically feeling something at the same, you know, at the same time as someone else, is that what you mean by perhaps that spectrum?
Yeah, so we have our own thoughts as well as our feelings, obviously, at the same time. So the affective empathy is the kind of feeling side of it. And then the cognitive empathy is the thoughts that go alongside that.
So that is really helpful, the fact that you have your own thoughts and your own feelings, and the two are combined when it comes to thinking about empathy, is cognitive and affective. And understanding that definition a little bit more in terms of the two parts. So this kind of led us to then start to think about, well, what is empathy actually for? Like, why do we need to increase our awareness to this? You know, what is empathy enabling for people? And I just wondered if you've kind of in your travels started to identify where, you know, what's the evolutionary level of empathy? Why bother? Why do we need it?
Well, at its most basic evolutionary level, I'd say that empathy developed to promote our social well-being. Mm-hmm. Cognitive empathy, for example, which was the person's ability to accurately imagine someone else's perspective, allows us to be the best we can in difficult social situations. In the past, this might have been encountering someone from a different tribe or caring for our own. But today, this could be having difficult conversations with other people, reacting to challenges, or simply being part of multiple teams. Our brains are constantly trying to predict what's about to happen in order to predict our needs and help us to meet them and other people's needs. We rapidly draw on past experiences to know what to expect in the near future. And it seems likely that we evolved emotions to help us make quick decisions, influence our behavior, and aid our survival. In modern day life, they're less important for life or death decisions and more important for influencing our behavior in smaller ways, for example, in social interactions. To promote social well-being, we behave in ways that will allow us to make connections with other people and maintain them. A key part of this process is being able to empathize with other people. And we often need to be able to imagine their perspective of the situation and respond in appropriate ways.
So that's really interesting, taking this kind of concept of where, you know, where emotions evolve from as well, and why, you know, how they're almost being used and important for our, you know, our everyday life, and how that might have changed from being, you know, something in the past in terms of, as you say, you know, sort of flight or fight maybe, but actually much more into that. How's that enabling us in conversations today and forming fast social connections? So what evolutionary benefits then has empathy brought us as human beings?
Well, empathy probably evolved because it was an evolutionary advantage to our ancestors. In a simple sense, babies communicate their emotions by crying or smiling, prompting empathetic caregivers to react and look after the child. And if the child is better taken care of, they're more likely to survive and pass on the characteristics of empathy to their children in the future. Mm-hmm. In addition, humans are social, so being part of a group is really important to us, and it's been evolutionarily important for our survival. People who are more empathetic may have been more likely to get along with other people and be included in groups, helping other people when necessary, meaning that the group would be healthier and more productive. Therefore, these people would have been more likely to survive and pass on their empathetic characteristics to their children. Empathy is a really important part of mental well-being. People who have high levels of empathy are likely to function well in society, having satisfying relationships both in their personal lives and at work, and experience their social interactions as more meaningful and positive, according to a study by Daniel Brune and colleagues. The authors found that empathy tends to stay the same throughout our lives. And although older people tended to experience less empathy, empathy did not reduce with age. So the differences reflected different generations.
Interesting. So there's a real connection then in terms of, needing it in young age as a kind of survival mechanism, learning it in young age, perhaps passing that on, and you know the need for that in society, but also this level of maintaining a certain degree of empathy, you know, throughout generations, and you know the necessity for that, just to live and to operate around different people. I was also having a look at this from, in terms of like, why is it important now from an evolutionary point of view? And why has it become such a big topic from a business perspective as well? And there's some key empathy indexes now are starting to show that businesses who build empathetic cultures, and that's recognizing the emotional impact we have on others, retains talents, creates environments for diversity to thrive, and is also a good indicator of financial growth. And I think it's because emotion perhaps isn't just felt, you know, within an organization. It's not something that, you know, empathy isn't just creating a culture within, but it's also creating a culture outside of organizations too. So there's a lot of work being done in terms of how you really listen to customers, how you empathize with customers and stakeholders. You know, how does that enable a completely different way of operating, a different way of being as organization and individuals? And I think in terms of, you know, the case for perhaps building empathy has become really strong over the course of the last 2 years and the pandemic. And in fact, it actually ranks as one of the most important skills for leaders and for managers today. And Forbes magazine last year claimed that empathy is actually the number one business disruptor. So that's up there with AI and all other forms of disruptive technology that we've been talking about for years. But actually, when you know the pandemic hit and we had that technology, we had that opportunity to interact, perhaps not to the degree that it's still coming, but that moment of being able to constantly be together, you know, the vital human skill that kind of cemented the importance over that pandemic has actually created almost like a generational shift in the way that people want to work and how they want to experience each other. You know, that's a very sort of pivotal moment for us to recognize that actually, if we're going to engage with 2D individuals, the way we have to do that is by really trying to understand, you know, emotions and our empathy and towards each other. So how do we do that through a screen? And what that's done is it's created a bit of a cascade and a generational change, and breaking, you know, breaking divisions, making it okay to say how you really feel, creating a sense of belonging and value, and getting people talking and perhaps also experimenting to push boundaries. So a real kind of human shift that's enabled others to, you know, perhaps change the dynamic of what, you know, what business and culture looks like going forward too. So right from, you know, babies, as you say, and you know, tribes, all the way up to, you know, how do we enable this with, you know, AI and disruptive technology? It's like a consistent core the human skill. Where do we start with this in terms of how we build empathy, and how we start to, you know, perhaps focus on this as something that's really foundational and useful for us?
So I looked quite a lot into this area because it was one of the starting points for me. I was looking at how to change our behaviour and how do we start, how do we learn a new way of acting or being? So, for example, the ideas that were out there were building better listening skills, spending time with babies or children who can't easily express their needs. And obviously this causes us to focus on the child or the pet. And use their body language and other communication signals to support them. There was a study in 2016 by Mark Helms and Lerner, which provided evidence that distraction leads to less empathetic accuracy. In this study, empathetic accuracy was measured by finding correlations between participants' inferences about their partner's emotions and their partner's own assessments of their emotions. The article highlighted the importance of listening to the other person carefully and ensuring that they feel understood before trying to make them feel better, for example, by sympathizing with them or encouraging them. From a cognitive standpoint, this makes sense. We should try to understand the other person's perspective and work out how they're feeling. And naturally, if you're not paying attention to what they're saying, whether you're focused on your own internal thoughts or not, you won't have a good understanding of their point of view. However, ironically, our own internal feelings in these situations may give us better insight into how the other person is feeling, as our own bodies reflect theirs to promote social connection. Therefore, if we consider our own interoceptive signals, then we may better understand the other person's situation and their emotions better.
So how do we break out of the concept of building emotion by thinking or placing ourselves in someone else's shoes or looking to the other person, you know, sort of focusing on others first? And, you know, how can we embrace that effective empathy without, you know, perhaps necessarily feeling bad at the same time? How do we find that balance between the two? How can, you know, this counterintuitive move that you've been talking about, how can that help us? How does interoception enable us to be better at empathy?
So interoception as a concept is the communication between the organs and the brain. And although we can't usually feel our organs, our brains are constantly receiving signals from them and sending signals back to them, which lets us know about the internal state of the body. And this can be affected by signals from the outside world as well as processes inside of our bodies. And there's evidence to suggest that bodily sensations actually cause us to feel our emotions. For example, we may know that we're anxious because our heart beats faster and harder, our body feels shaky, and our stomach feels knotted. And we can distinguish this from the emotion of sadness, which may make our body feel heavy, slow, and empty. Therefore, it's our interoceptive ability that determines how much we feel our emotions. If we have low interoceptive accuracy or sensitivity, we may feel our emotions less intensely and with less understanding than people with high interoceptive accuracy. But the importance of interoceptive training is that we can kind of work out ways to regulate ourselves so that we can decide how much we feel an emotion and then what we do based on that emotion.
So this is literally then a sense of feeling on the inside, like raising awareness to what's going on inside that, you know, enables us to register what's happening in our bodies. Is that like when your stomach rumbles and you're getting lightheaded and then, you know, you clock you need to eat? Is that an example of actually paying attention to the inside?
Yeah, exactly. So interoception is feeling our internal sensations, and interoceptive awareness is consciously registering these sensations. In terms of why we should pay attention to interoception, it's all about regulating our bodies as a whole, our mental and physical well-being. If we feel lightheaded, as you said, and our stomach rumbling, it's our body encouraging us to eat something so that we can continue to function, basically. In the same way, when we feel frightened, our body may shake and feel uncomfortable to encourage us to remove ourselves from that situation in order to maintain our well-being. Interoceptive accuracy is a measure of how well we can determine our inner state. For example, many studies measure heart rate using a pulsometer and then asks participants to count their heartbeats without checking their pulse, and how close they are to the real number is a measure of their interoceptive accuracy.
Not many people kind of necessarily think about that. I mean, what have you found just off the cuff here in terms of, you know, reading? How much of the population would you say is is kind of aware of what's going on inside, can count the heart, you know, heartbeat without thinking about it?
I'm not really sure, but there's a lot of different things that can make you better at it. For example, if you're an athlete, then you're more used to the sensations of like your heart beating hard and fast while you're exercising, which may make you more aware of your internal sensations and that kind of thing. So if you're used to that being how it feels when you're running around, for example, then it's easier to acknowledge that that's what's happening when you feel a bit anxious and your heart's beating in the same way.
Is it like when you're standing up to do a presentation or something and you've got that fear, at least I do, where my heart will pound, and if I'm really honest, my nose runs. So if anybody out there knows the reason why that happens, I'd love to know. But you know, that, I mean, it's taken me years to recognize that that's kind of my body telling me something. Is that interoception?
Yeah, definitely. So depending on the situation, you'll have a variety of different feelings coming from your body, and your body will react in different ways. So the combination of the feelings that we receive from our body allows us to work out which emotion we're actually feeling. And preliminary studies have found that interoceptive training improves interoceptive accuracy, and in doing so, reduces anxiety. It's especially beneficial for many people with autism, as many autistic people experience heightened anxiety levels and low interoceptive accuracy.
So is the link there then? You said something really important in terms of understanding the emotion. So my understanding is that this is a key part of being able to almost identify, locate, and label how you're really feeling, like the emotion that you're experiencing. You know, it might be different to someone else, but that's it's information that's telling you how you're feeling.
Yeah, so if you're able to work out the emotion that your body is experiencing, then it can be a lot easier to actually regulate your body. So if you can understand that you are feeling anxious and that your heart is beating fast because you're feeling anxious and there's adrenaline going around your body, then a good way to regulate yourself and reduce your heart rate is to take deep breaths. People always say it, but it's true. And it really lowers your heart rate and gets it feeling a bit more normal. And once you're receiving less distressing signals from your body, then it's easier to think rationally and work out what you're going to do because of that anxiety, or what that anxiety is telling you that you should be doing. So it's easier to choose what you're going to do next when you've regulated your body a bit and calmed yourself down.
Understood. So far from trying to ignore, you know, the butterflies in your tummy, or the sweaty palms, or which is already like the body's already told you ages ago, if you were quick enough to recognize that something's happening, you know, rather than ignore it, is actually register it, like become aware of it, and quickly get to a point where you can label it, understand it, name it, and then work with it, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. So if you can name it quickly, basically, then you can acknowledge that that's what you're feeling. You can work out a way to make yourself feel a bit better so that you can tolerate the emotion more. And then you can work out where you're going to go from there.
Okay. So you've delved into this wonderful world of interoception. How new is it in terms of an area? What have you started to find? You know, are there any really good examples of studies and things that you've started to recognize in this work?
So the research in this area has been going for quite a while. To be honest, the first one that I found was in 1974 that showed that interoceptive training improves interoceptive accuracy. But the best example was a study by Damasio and colleagues, and it really helps to understand the concept of interoception. because they demonstrated the ways in which the body understands things on an unconscious level before a conscious level. And they did this using a gambling game. So the players were presented with a game on a computer in which they started with $2,000 and were given four decks of cards, which were face down. When they turned over a card, it would state whether it was a bonus or a penalty and how much they had won or lost. They were tasked with choosing cards which would reward them with the most money. They were unaware that the researchers had designed the game such that the decks A and B were bad, i.e. contained more penalties, and decks C and D were good, i.e. contained more rewards. As they played, the participants wore electrodes on their fingers, tracking their level of perspiration. When our bodies detect a potential threat, they begin to sweat slightly, so the researchers could detect when the body knew about the threat, which was the bad decks. After only 10 cards and 45 seconds had passed, the electrodes detected that the participants perspired more when they considered clicking on one of the bad decks. Hence, their body knew that the game was rigged at this stage. However, the participants had no conscious idea about the additional penalties of decks A and B until several minutes had passed and 50 cards had been turned. Interestingly, during the game, the players were avoiding the bad decks and increasingly choosing the good decks, even though they had no conscious knowledge of why. Their bodies had worked out how to succeed in the game well before their brains did. But further research found that people with greater interoceptive awareness were better at choosing the good decks than those with low interoceptive awareness.
Well, that's amazing, isn't it? That you are actually hovering over something and your body can tell you that, like, not to, almost like not to touch it before you've even sort of clocked. I've heard about this study before, and I think it's fascinating that you gravitated to that as like an absolute, like, key example. You know, why do you love this one so much? What is it about this study that really makes you, you know, cements interoception for you?
Well, I think it's just a really great example that shows us that our bodies can understand information that is far more complicated than our conscious minds can actually handle. And our bodies can work it out far faster than our brains as well. So if we listen to our bodies, then we gain an advantage over just thinking, and we can process more complex information at a faster rate.
Gosh. So that's like a great example of like why interoception, almost like the case for listening to our bodies. And I know that you've been absorbed in this research, and it's amazing that there's a lot going back to like 1970s as well. But, you know, I think what we're about to hear and some of the things that you're about to pull out here is almost like the journey that you've taken in terms of, you know, what's fascinated you and the direction of travel, and why it's giving us like a far richer understanding of how this concept of, you know, feeling from the inside could be really useful in our actual interactions with others. So I'd love to just hear where you've started to go with this. How have you started to draw some links?
Yeah, so what I found was that we use our own experiences to understand the feelings and perspectives of other people. Mm-hmm. So we use our interoceptive abilities to make sense of not only our own emotions, but also other people's emotions. And this is backed up by neuroimaging evidence. For example, from a study by Stoiker and Depew in 2020, which showed that brain regions used when empathizing overlap with those used in self-experience. So when people we are emotionally close with experience pain or emotions, our bodily physiology changes slightly to mimic theirs. So we feel their emotions to some extent. And the underlying biological basis for this is something called mirror neurons, neurons which fire equally whether we are doing something ourselves or watching someone else do the thing. And we can understand painful situations in others because observing them activates similar neural circuits to those which activate if we are the ones experiencing the sensations and the feelings associated with the pain.
So you literally are feeling and going through what that other person is feeling and going through.
Yeah, so we experience their sensations probably to a lower level, but okay. It really helps us to understand their perspective and what's going on inside their bodies, and it helps us link with what's probably going on inside their brains as well.
And do we have to make that conscious? Is, you know, would we be doing that even if we didn't, you know, have this, as you call it, interoceptive accuracy?
Yeah, so we're definitely doing it to some extent if we don't make a conscious effort to do it, because that's the basis of empathy. But if we actually acknowledge it, then it's likely that we'll be better at it and that it'll help us to better support other people.
So a message here, in a way, is that when you're around people, I'm guessing that you're close to, there is a very real, if you hadn't acknowledged it now, there's a very real chance, high probability, that actually you are experiencing what the other person's experiencing if you raise your awareness to it.
Yeah, so a great example of this was a study by Fisher and colleagues in 2014. Mm-hmm. And it shows our physiology mimicking other people's physiology. So the researchers monitored the hearts of people who were undertaking a hot coal walking ritual. And they also monitored the hearts of people that were watching, some of whom were close friends and family, and some of whom were complete strangers. And the research found that the more socially connected to the individual on the hot coals the observer was, the more closely their heart rates mirrored each other. And I think this finding really showed to me that it's the greater social bond between two people that causes their physiology to reflect each other's, implying that we may experience heightened empathy in relation to each other's experiences. And what I thought from that was that this could have implications on how well we work together as part of a team, as we're more likely to understand how someone is feeling and their perspective if we have a greater bond with them. So if we want to improve how we work as part of a team with other people, then it might be good to start with improving our social bonds with them by sharing stories, listening to them, and getting to know them, really.
Or doing hot coal walking, by the sounds of it. Have you ever done hot coal walking?
No, I haven't. Not.
I actually did do this for charity once, and my now husband came and watched. And it would be amazing knowing what you've just shared with me now, because I definitely remember him like watching that he recorded it, and I remember listening back to it, like the sounds of him watching it, like, oh, ow, oh, ah. It's like maybe he was just, you know, experiencing that as well. I walked very fast and didn't really think about it. So that's you should give it a go. It's quite amazing what you could do when you put your mind to it. But so I guess that's what that's starting to show, is this connect, like the need or the desire for social bonds. And that's the thing that I find when I'm working with a team, especially if they're quite fluid or they're moving and changing quite quickly, that feels like something that's quite indulgent to spend time and get to know. It's like, it's almost, we haven't got the time to do this, we need to move on. But actually, you know, the level of connection, by the sounds of it, you can make by, you know, forming those bonds, and literally that experience that you're getting at a, you know, at a vicarious level is potentially worth the investment if you're going to be with someone or working with someone for the long run. And yes. I guess is that suggesting that the more we know someone, the greater the likelihood is that perhaps our bodies will feel in the same way as a result of an external stimulus? So we might, you know, if I'm thinking of a team environment, for example, and, you know, something comes in that's completely out of, you know, scope of what we'd originally thought we were working on, etc., or we're working, you know, firefighting is that language that tends to get used as well. Are we, you know, the closer our bond, are we both experiencing that in the same way based on that, you know, shared external stimulus?
Well, I think to some extent that's true, but it's not just the external stimulus that creates our feelings. So we don't see hot coals and make a quick logical conclusion that they must be feeling pain. We can have the same reaction even if the external stimulus isn't known to us. So there was a study that has shown that physiological markers are mirrored by observers of people experiencing emotions, even if they're in a photograph. For example, people looking at photos of sad faces often experience a physiological sign of sadness, which is reduced pupil size. And this is perhaps so that the brain's interoception center, the insula, receives interoceptive information from the body indicating that it's sad, in order to better empathize with others and promote social connection.
So is it possible then for anyone to switch on interoceptive accuracy and build their awareness to their body and what that's, you know, what that body or their body, sorry, is experiencing when they're with others, you know, in that moment?
Yeah, definitely. So many people imagine empathy and interoception as quite stable traits, but there's a lot of evidence that these skills can be improved upon. A great study by Sugawara and colleagues in 2020 used a heartbeat discrimination task to assess people's interoceptive abilities before and after 1 week of interoceptive training. The participants had their heartbeats monitored and were played a sound either at the same time as or slightly out of time with the heartbeats. And after 10 bleeps, they had to choose whether they thought the sound was synchronized with their hearts or not. And after that, they were immediately given feedback as to whether they were correct or not, so that they could improve their interoceptive skills. And even short training periods, for example, in this study, there were 4 40-minute training sessions over 1 week, and this improved their accuracy at the task.
Do you know if it's something that can get lost as well? Just going off piece now, in terms of accuracy. Is it something you have to keep training at? Or once you've got it, it becomes almost innate?
I'd say you probably have to keep training, because if you get used to it too much and kind of slip and don't think about it, then your body, the pathways basically in your brain aren't going to be used as much. So then your body might forget to some extent. Mm-hmm. But I think like any amount of training is going to be beneficial.
So where's the connection then? Between interoception and empathy, what have you started to experience or read about or understand in some of this research?
There have been a few different studies. So one study was in 2011 by Fukushima and colleagues. I think I mentioned this in the introduction, but they measured the brain's electrical response to the heart beating whilst people did a task requiring empathy. And in this study, the participants were asked to judge how positive or negative they imagined the person in a photo to be feeling, or a control task, which was not related to how anyone was feeling. It was just a cognitive task. And during the empathy task, the brain's electrical response to the heart beating was greater than in the control task, which showed that the brain responded more to the heart beating when we were empathizing with other people. So this is what indicates that we use our own interoceptive signals to inform us about the emotional states of other people, because the participants weren't asked to pay greater attention to their hearts. They just naturally did it. So this shows that the brain naturally increases interoceptive sensitivity, that is how sensitive we are to the feelings on our inside when we're empathizing. And there was another study that used people's scores of their own empathy levels. So they filled out a survey called the Interpersonal Reactivity Index Survey. And on a 5-point scale, they answered questions such as, before criticizing somebody, I try to imagine how they would feel if I were in their place. And they used these scores with their brain's electrical response to their heartbeat and compared them. They found that the higher their empathy score, the more that their brain responded to the heart beating, which reinforces the idea that we use the sensory information that we receive from our hearts to empathize with other people, even when we're not thinking about it.
It's almost like it's locked inside. If our heart, you know, if our hearts are responding to other people, to you know, when we're empathizing with others, and yet we don't recognize it, it's like our body's got there faster than our, you know, our consciousness has.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's really important to actually think about how your body is reacting to things, because if you think about it, then you're gaining kind of an advantage in social situations where your body is telling you what's going on. Like, you get extra information about the situation that you can use to work out what you're going to do next.
So how can we begin to perhaps start to use this awareness? So it's happening. It's out there. It's real. The research shows it. But actually, I'd guess there's not a massive part of the population who's really tapped into this. So how do we do it? How do we raise awareness to this?
When I started looking at this research, I began asking a very similar question, because I was wondering, why would we bother doing this? And how does paying attention to what we're feeling on the inside help us when we're around other people? And the first thing I found was it helps us to build deeper social connection and understanding of other people. When our bodily physiology mimics people around us, it activates our brain's interoception center, which is called the insula, allowing us to vicariously experience the other person's emotions and understand their perspective better. And this vicarious experience may also motivate us to try and understand the issues that they are facing in order to allow us to help them and reduce their emotional distress. Researchers have hypothesized that a greater ability to work out bodily sensations provides a richer emotional experience, which may facilitate a better understanding of other people's emotions, promoting empathy, understanding, and sharing, which are all skills which enable social connection. Another thing that it helps us with is surviving difficult social interactions. People with better interoceptive ability report fewer negative emotions and moods after experiencing challenging social situations. For example, in studies, this has been tested using impromptu public speaking. People with greater interoceptive accuracy experience less anxiety and negative emotions before and after impromptu public speaking, although their bodily reactions are quite comparable with other people's. This implies that the social stress experience is not entirely due to bodily sensations, but also a result of how we interpret what these signals mean. People with greater interoceptive accuracy may be able to identify that their body's reaction is a result of an objective external situation rather than a reflection of themselves, allowing them to better regulate their emotional response. And it also helps us to better predict what other people might do next. Social interactions rely on us being able to shift attention from extraception, external stimuli, such as what we can see and hear, to interoception, in order to understand the other person's intentions and emotions, as well as our own emotional reactions to them. Our brains are constantly trying to predict what will happen in the near future so that we can efficiently control our actions and regulate our bodies. Therefore, if we understand other people better by understanding how we feel when we're around them, we'll be able to predict their behavior better and put less energy into predicting what they'll do, which should translate into us working more efficiently with them.
Gosh, so there are three potential game changers in here. When I think about number of times that I work with people on things that really challenge them the most, I think 9 times out of 10, they'll say working with people or working with others because they just can't control the outcome. And we can build immense trust with people, but one tiny trigger can have a change in behaviour, put our relationships back by so many months. So I think that that prediction point that you made here is really important. So that ability to almost, we keep saying this, but to be with others and recognise that you have something within you that enables you to navigate that situation. And also, in a way, it feels like also calm that situation with the other person too. So it becomes less about the, you know, the intense emotional reaction to actually, you know, the sense of, you know, a regulated behavior that we can operate with.
Yeah, and there are also other parts of teamwork which interoception helps with. So in terms of perspective taking, a study by Heydrich and colleagues in 2020 found a link between interoception, empathy, and perspective taking. They used a diagram of a human outline in various orientations, and the participants had to ascertain which hand was highlighted whilst the outline flashed either in sync with or out of sync with their heartbeat. Participants with higher empathy were significantly better at the task when the outline flashed in sync with their heartbeats, potentially because it was easier to adopt the virtual body's perspective when the visual and interoceptive signals aligned. But people with low self-reported empathy were no better at the task whether the light was flashing in time with or out of time with their hearts. Empathy correlates with perspective taking, so this evidence suggests that once we form social bonds with others and our physiology mimics theirs, we may find it easier to empathize and work with them, as we may have a faster and greater understanding of their perspective. So if we can improve our interoceptive awareness and hence our empathy, we might be able to enhance our perspective taking when working as part of a team. Another really important thing when working as part of a team is seeing social cues. And intriguingly, people with higher interoceptive accuracy have a greater region from which they become aware of visual information that's related to social connection. In the study, this was another person's hand, but not a metal stick. And this implies that if we improve our interoceptive abilities, we allow ourselves more opportunities for social connectivity. So the more in tune with ourselves we are, the more likely we are to notice someone attempting to connect with us. And this could have implications on our ability to work as part of a team. We might form connections faster and be more inclined to participate with strangers if we're more open to their social connection cues.
This one, I think, is really interesting from a working on screen and perhaps, you know, in terms of a team environment, because the number of times that I number of team calls that I sit on and watch teams interacting, I know that many people actually don't even see, you know, the virtual hands go up, or they don't recognize the you know, the desire to speak, or the kind of looking up, or the, and I appreciate that's also because you have to be staring and looking at the screen to recognize it. But, you know, is there, I mean, it's all hypotheses here, but is there anything that makes you think that there's something that could be built for that environment in terms of those social cues?
I guess it is a lot harder when you're just on a call with someone, because you don't have access to all of the social cues that you normally have access to. Like, you can't see their whole body to see their body language, and they won't have the body language that you're used to them having, because they're not actually sat in a room with you. A lot of people mimic each other's body language, whether they do it consciously or subconsciously. And I think it allows our bodies to know that we are kind of comfortable with each other when we do that. And when we're just on a phone call, we don't get those kind of signals.
But I guess there's something in this that's saying, you know, when you're working with people for the first time, or perhaps you're going through that first stage of coming together as a group, there is a recognition of, like, just acknowledging how you're feeling in that space and how your body's feeling, and being more aware of what's around you, like from that visual perspective.
Yeah, so if you can be really honest when you first meet people, then it would be a lot easier for your body to work out what everyone's thinking and feeling. But that isn't always how our social interactions work.
No, that's very true. We actually become more guarded, don't we? Or yeah, can do, in terms of how we, you know, how we regulate ourselves in that space. Interesting. Is there anything else in this wonderful world of teamwork that you're starting to draw connections on?
Yeah, so there's also a point about regulating your own emotions when you're around other people, which I think is a really important part of life, like whether you're working as part of a team or just in your day-to-day life. When someone that you have a close relationship with is distressed, it can be quite hard to maintain your own well-being, especially if they're distressed over quite a long period of time. There was a study in 2020 I mentioned before by Stoica and Depew, which found that although cognitive empathy was positively associated with interoceptive awareness, affective empathy, which is vicariously experiencing the emotions of other people, this was negatively associated with interoceptive awareness. So the greater the person's interoceptive awareness, the less they vicariously experience the emotions of other people. And these results were consistent using two different techniques of measuring brain activity: resting functional connectivity and functional activity. And this could be because affective empathy motivates us to detach from our internal feelings, either as a method of emotional regulation or to focus more on the other person. Being interoceptively sensitive allows us to become aware of an internal emotion cue early, helping us to quickly evaluate the other person's emotional state, meaning that we can support them better.
So the balance is, you want to feel for someone else without genuinely getting that sense of pain or anger or upset or...
Yeah, so I think the main point is that you can feel the internal sensations of the other person's emotions without thinking and feeling the thoughts associated with distress.
Yes.
So you can work out what they mean or what they're thinking and feeling without necessarily feeling distressed yourself.
Yes. So you're not carrying that person's distress or pain or suffering, but you're able to be in it enough to find a way to help.
Yeah.
If indeed help is the right way. So, Oscar, you're building the case very clearly for this counterintuitive move. We've had, regulating our own emotions when we were others, perspective taking, seeing those social cues early, and also that ability to, build deeper social connection and understanding, survive those difficult social interactions. And the one I really love is that ability to perhaps predict what others are going to do next, purely just by focusing, counterintuitively on yourself. So if we're looking within ourselves to build empathy rather than focusing on the other person, how can someone who may never have heard of interoception before today, so this might be the first time they've thought about when their stomach rumbles, for example, what's that really telling them, or how often do they clock it? How often do they try and quell it? How can someone who's taking this concept for the first time today begin to really work on this new super skill and put it not only to their own benefit of perhaps knowing when a deck of cards is loaded or not, but also like recognizing that it's going to have potentially huge benefits when they're interacting with other people as well?
Yeah, well, given that bodily cues are the basis of emotions and empathy, it should come as no surprise at this point that the body is at the center of improving interoception, emotion regulation, and empathy. So there are a variety of ways to improve interoceptive abilities. A few that I've come across include interoceptive training, vagal nerve stimulation, exercise, and power posing. I think that working on your interoceptive skills can seem like quite a daunting task, especially if you have never really paid much attention to your internal sensations previously. But understanding your bodily sensations can make uncomfortable sensations more tolerable as you begin to see them for what they are, physical reactions to stimuli. And as a result, the confusion associated with these feelings is minimized, so you don't need to worry about why you feel uncomfortable. Therefore, you're less likely to feel bad or stressed about how you feel. Beginning to improve your interoceptive accuracy can be as easy as thinking about how your body feels throughout the day. You can think about how your stomach feels when you have eaten food, how your mouth feels when you haven't had a drink in a while, and how your heart feels when you're exercising. If you're someone that often feels anxious about things, you may think that actively noticing your bodily sensations could cause you more anxiety. But the evidence shows that interoceptive training reduces the levels of anxiety that people feel, whether they have an anxiety disorder or not. So children are taught about interoception using stories. They can be taught about using interoception, even if they are not told the specific word, to understand their feelings and link them to their emotions and how to regulate them. They can also be taught about awareness of feelings that can be easily created, such as temperature and the vocabulary associated with different feelings and emotions. And the other thing that can be taught easily in schools, but also to adults, is interoceptive training. A phrase that we use quite a lot in neuroscience is neurons that fire together, wire together. And it's a phrase that was first used by neuropsychologist Donald Hebb in 1949 to describe how repetition reinforces pathways in the brain. Basically, the more frequently the brain does a task, the stronger and more efficient the pathway becomes, so the easier it will be to be activated in the future. Hence, if you practice interoception in your daily life, it'll be easier to tap into your interoceptive signals when you need them. And the easiest way to begin interoceptive training is to start by sitting in a comfortable position with your eyes closed and just apply pressure to a part of your body and feel the sensations for a minute and try and describe what you feel. You can repeat this all over your body and just try to acknowledge the feelings and try to describe them. And then you should try and turn your focus to the inside of the body and spend a few minutes focusing on the feeling of breathing in and out. You can choose an area, an internal area of your body, such as your abdomen, thigh muscles, or heart, and concentrate on the feeling of the sensations in that area and trying to describe them. The feeling of the heart beating in particular has been shown to play a part in emotion processing, so focusing on your heart regularly might be especially beneficial. Another interoceptive training exercise involves noticing when you experience an emotion or feeling in everyday life, or feel a strong urge to act in a certain way. So first, you should try to turn your attention inwards and investigate sensations that you feel inside your body and try and describe them to yourself. Describing them is important because it helps you to really acknowledge them and work out what they are. You can note which areas feel tense or uncomfortable and which feel pleasant or light. And next, you should consider any alternative explanations there might be for these sensations. And then you can choose how you want to act based on these. For example, if you feel annoyed, you might realize that your abdomen is tense and your heart is pounding and consider that you might be worried about something. So instead of snapping at someone, you can take some deep breaths, regulate yourself, and express your worry instead of your frustration. If you're feeling anxious, you might notice that you feel lightheaded and work out that you might be hungry. So you can choose to eat something to see if this helps reduce your anxiety.
Gosh. So what have you done in this area for yourself based on a bit of training? Have you taken any of this on board?
Yeah, so because I've been researching it quite a lot recently, I think about it quite a lot in my daily life. So If I feel especially anxious one day, then I might consider which parts of me are indicating to my brain that I'm feeling anxious. And if I'm just feeling a bit shaky, then I can think, well, it's been a few hours since I ate something, so my blood sugar might be low. I might try eating something and then see if this helps how I'm feeling. Because it's not just the feelings themselves. You have to remember that it's your brain's automatic interpretations of these feelings. Mm-hmm. So your brain might be just telling you that you feel anxious, but your body is just saying you're shaky. So it's important to think about them properly and not just accept the interpretations that your brain automatically comes to, because there might be another reason for feeling like that.
That's really key, I think, is that actually being able to look at both. It's almost like the story that my brain's telling me to try and make sense of it, whereas actually if I just look at what the body's doing sensing or feeling, then I can make a different interpretation.
It gives you
different access to some, you know, some behaviors that you can take on the back of it.
Yeah, and once you have all the information, then you can think about what you want to do with that information. Mm-hmm. So you can try eating something or try taking some deep breaths and regulate your body. And then if you still feel bad, then maybe take yourself away from that situation. Maybe you need a little break. But you can find ways to make your bodily sensations more tolerable for you, which is really good for your mental health. It's just really important to be able to tolerate the feelings that you're experiencing so that then you can be rational and you can logically work out what you want to do next.
Mm-hmm. I've got a great example of needing to eat before. If I have anything that goes over like a 12 till 2, sometimes we have some sessions like that. I know that I need to eat to be a nice person. Because otherwise I'm just not the person that I want to be in that space, and it's purely down to food. And it's crazy because you can actually see the reactions from people on the screen where I'm just like, oh, it's me who's creating this, but it's not even me, it's my stomach.
Yeah, it's really interesting how much of a difference it can make to how we react to things, especially when we automatically react to things and don't think about them fully.
Yeah,
how our body is feeling really affects what we do in those situations.
But isn't that amazing to think if more people were aware of this or really jumped on this, then actually, you know, could we stop those difficult encounters? Probably not, because sometimes we need to have that conversation, but at least we'd be doing it from an informed place as opposed to a reaction of what's going on inside. Wouldn't it be amazing if we all sat on a call over 12 till 2 and went, on a scale of 1 to 10, how hungry are we? And how is that impacting, you know, how we feel about each other today?
Yeah, definitely. It would be really interesting to see what would happen if everyone actually became a lot more aware of how they were feeling.
Yes.
More honest about it with other people. Because you might be having that conversation and then think, I might be hungry, but it's hard to stop that interaction because it's already taking place. So if we could all be honest and be like, actually, I need a break. I need to have a snack, because then I might react better in this situation. Then it would be better, but it's quite complex socially, I think, to work that out, especially because for the whole of our lives, even starting at school, we're taught to ignore these sensations.
Yes.
We're taught that we can only eat at lunchtime. We can only go to the toilet at break.
Mm.
And if our body is uncomfortable, then we're bound to do things that are not what we would like to do in an ideal situation.
Yeah. So I've got an Apple Watch, and a lot of people I'm certain have similar, obviously other brands available, but it tells me to stand. I know it's automated, and I know it's also looking at a certain amount of movement, but it's a really good nudge for me quite regularly to be like, whoa, yeah, actually, how is my body feeling? And I'll be like, I can't actually feel my feet, you know, I need to do something. But it's it's weird, isn't it, how you almost need that nudge to tell you, whereas if you become, like you were saying, with the, you know, athletes or people who just, they just do, like, they're using that as information, it just makes them stronger. You know, there's, we're just a wealth of stuff we're not even tapping into. Wow. Okay. Is there more that you found? Do you want to share any more?
Yeah. So there was some information that I found on vagal nerve stimulation.
You're going to have to explain vagal nerve, I think.
Yes. So the vagal nerve is the main nerve that brings information from the body to the brain about how we're feeling on the inside. So it's really important. It's basically how we receive interoceptive signals from the body. It's the main pathway for that. And there is some evidence that stimulating this nerve could improve our interoceptive abilities. Stimulating the vagus nerve has been shown to improve a range of clinical conditions, including PTSD, anxiety, and depression. However, these studies focus on electrically stimulating the vagus nerve, which isn't really practical at home without medical professionals. Nevertheless, there are a few ways to stimulate the vagus nerve at home, which include focusing on your breathing to make sure that you take 6 breaths a minute, splashing your face with cold water, or closing your eyes and extremely gently pressing against them with your fingers. But it's important to note that these techniques haven't been assessed to see if they improve interoceptive awareness, but they can be used to stimulate the vagus nerve. So there's kind of indirect evidence for that one, that it could be beneficial for your interoceptive skills.
It's just recognizing that that's the mechanism, I think, is as important. And that almost that kind of direct connection, as you say, you know, from the body to the brain. Yeah. I like the idea of closing your eyes and just gently tapping your eyelids every so often. I'd love to see more people doing that.
I guess things like that are quite relaxing in themselves. So you're likely to feel your internal sensations if you're relaxed.
Yeah. Oh, and then on the flip side, I can see where you're going next. From relaxed, what else?
Yeah, so exercise. As I mentioned earlier, athletes are likely to have much greater interoceptive awareness. Exercise itself has been shown for a long time to have powerful influences over bodily well-being. But more recently, scientists have looked into the effects of exercise on interoception. Many of the interoceptive sensations that we experience when we are exercising are similar to those sensations when we're distressed or anxious. So if you exercise more often, you get used to the sensations of your body and can identify them more easily. So when you experience emotional distress, you might find it easier to identify that your body is reacting strongly and use strategies to reduce your bodily response. And you may, in doing this, also reduce the negative interpretations that your brain has of what the bodily signals mean, such as anxiety, and you might become more likely to notice them objectively. So you don't get upset about them, but you just notice that they are there, basically. And as a result of this, you might feel calmer and more able to tackle whatever challenges you're facing. Another thing that I read was that if you're physically fitter, the organs become better at dealing with strain, which means that your body recovers faster after physical challenges. And since bodily reactions are the basis of emotions, you may also recover and feel more resilient when facing emotional challenges. So to improve your interoceptive sensitivity, you might try doing some cardio and become familiar with how your heart feels when it's beating hard, and then use techniques such as deep breathing to calm your heart down afterwards. And a lot of different types of exercise have these benefits, including less aerobic activities such as strength training.
Gosh. So actually the act of putting your body to different limits is, again, a useful, but it sounds a bit sort of awareness raiser. Again, to bring the watch with a certain make back in, you know, the the heartbeat on that is really fascinating for me sometimes. And, you know, in terms of how quickly and it can reduce and how fast, and just by going up and down some stairs, you know, you can really start to clock a difference and make a you know, just be aware of what's going on in your body.
I think it'd actually be really interesting to use that to your advantage. So if you're in a situation where you need to like get somewhere really quickly, maybe you have to run for the bus, then you can look at what your heart rate is when you sit down on the bus and see how it feels when it is going fast. And then maybe if you're in a stressful situation at a different time, you can see that your heart rate might be similar. Mm-hmm. And then you can take deep breaths so that you know that your it's just what your body is feeling, and you can work out why your body is feeling like that.
I'd love that if you could have like two columns with the same heart rate, and one is like when I ran for the bus, and the other was like when I need to talk to my boss. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, but now I can recognize that actually my body's just doing something similar. Then you've got to make sense of it, of course. Yeah. Like, why? But you can go, well, actually, no, it's just my running for the bus reaction.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, you tell yourself something different about, you know, what you're experiencing.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about the interpretation of these feelings in your brain.
Interesting. I feel like you've got one more for us, so I can just sense it.
Yeah, just one more thing I'd like to touch on. So focusing on your body can improve your interoceptive awareness. And there's some evidence that adopting a powerful position, which is called power posing, can improve interoceptive awareness whilst reducing anxiety and increasing feelings of power. But there was a study that by Vineck and colleagues in 2019 that found that interoception was improved by even a single session of power posing, but the effects were short-lived. Mm-hmm. There was also another study by the same people, but in 2020, which found that adopting both a natural and powerful position improved interoceptive accuracy after 2 weeks of training. So the authors suggested that this could have been because both positions were different from their usual positions, and therefore the participants focused on their posture. So I think the importance is focusing on your internal sensations. So it gets back to the interoceptive training technique of improving your interoceptive accuracy.
Amazing. So I think what you've managed to just highlight to us there is that there is a wealth of research that's forming and shaping and, you know, driving a new way of, you know, thinking about how we feel and how that enables us to feel and be with others. You know, I feel like we're still on the cusp of understanding that connection between that, as you called it, counterintuitive move of, you know, focusing on the inside and us to be better on the outside with others. You know, they're still trying to understand that, but there's already, you know, building the case for this being a, you know, a next route, a next opportunity to, you know, build a skill of empathy, but really by focusing on building skill of better emotional awareness for ourselves. And I know that you've been in this research now for several months. And every time I get to talk to you, I love it because you always bring something different and there's a new kind of like, oh, and there's this and that. But I mean, Oscar, in your own kind of takeaway from your experience of doing this and that very big question that we set out with at the start in terms of how we can be better with others, what are your kind of takeaway thoughts or you know, leave behinds for people?
I think the biggest conclusion that I found in all of the research was that any amount of training and focusing on your internal sensations can help you understand them and therefore be better in your general life at regulating yourself and also working with other people. So if you get a chance a few times a day or just once a day, maybe you're driving to work and you've got nothing else to do, you're just focusing on the road, but just think about what your body is feeling. And any amount of doing that is going to improve the pathways from your body to your brain. And if you can work on thinking about alternative conclusions to the ones that your brain automatically comes up with to why you're feeling that way, then I think that is a good place to start. And that is the ultimate goal, really, to work out how you want to deal with your feelings and how they can help you in different situations. So you can use any of these techniques to help you with that.
I just want to say thank you ever so much. I'm pleased that we could do that together. That felt satisfying. Right. Let's conquer the world by bringing people together.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
See ya. Bye.